Welcome to the latest edition of The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined as always by my colleague Stuart Mandel. We're going to have a good guest later today. Stu is the new head football coach at Oregon, Dan Lanning. We got a lot to talk to him as he begins his first spring as a head coach, coming off just winning a national title with the Georgia Bulldogs. And it's a team he's going to see very early in his tenure when he faces them with the Ducks. But before we get into that, you had a story that went up on Friday late in the day that was a very interesting look at NIL, from a contract you reviewed to a big money. For people who, I think, look at NIL and now they're a little bit numb to it, I think they see a lot of visibility, and I'm not sure they know what to make of the dollar figures. And I also think one of the things that has been kind of interesting for a lot of people is, what exactly does this mean from a recruiting standpoint? Because we've seen a bunch of these collectives, and now we've written a lot of stories at The Athletic between David Ubbin's story on Tennessee. Seth Emerson did one recently on Georgia this week. And now your story, kind of on the flip side of it, coming from an attorney who's working some of these deals. If people have not seen your story yet, what do you want them to know?
Right. So, like you said, I think people became numb pretty quickly to the concept of, oh, athletes can do endorsement deals now. They show up in ads. Like, that's not really the story of NIL anymore. The story of NIL is these collectives. And we had David Ubbin on here a few weeks ago to talk about Tennessee's and how they work, that have basically just come together and are now having a truly, truly direct and powerful influence on recruiting. And in this case, I found out that, and I saw the contract with my own eyes, that one of these schools' collectives made a deal with a five-star recruit. All I can say is he's a five-star recruit in the class of 2023. I had to keep him anonymous and the team anonymous to be able to review the contract. And it starts paying him almost immediately before he even gets to college. By the time he starts his freshman season at his school, he'll be making over $2 million a year. And, you know, the big number that catches everybody's eyes is that if he, you know, makes everything that's in the contract, and the contract says there's nothing to stop him from it, he could make more than $8 million by the end of his junior season. It's an insane amount.
So let me stop you here on this. And this is a question that you and I have talked offline about this story. But what I'm interested about for people who are looking at this is, there's, you don't have to be cynical to go, well, I thought NIL deals couldn't directly induce recruits. This is a collective that is in business for essentially one football program. So there's a disconnect there. Is it just wink, wink, nod, nod? The NCAA can't get at this because the language is kind of vague enough for people to get by on this?
Yeah, I mean, that's the crazy thing is that I think we all knew when NIL became official that there would be attempts to use it to entice recruits. I didn't know it'd be so out in the open and brazen. And so this is a contract. This is not, you know, under the table money like in the old days. This is a contract. And in the contract, it says explicitly, this is not an inducement for the athlete to attend any particular university. Also, there is no condition, you know, that he has to, basically the university that we think he's going to go to now is not mentioned in there anywhere. And in fact, it explicitly says this is not an inducement to play football at any particular school. So I have the same question you do, Bruce. Okay, you're going to promise this guy $8 million and you don't even have anything in writing that says he has to sign with the school. What's to stop him from taking the money and running? And the answer is, first of all, as the lawyer said, there's an element of trust involved. But I think one of the things that I wanted to spotlight in there is that he, in order to get the money, he has to hand over the exclusive rights to his NIL for the next 3 years. So this collective, not only is it raising money, it is then becomes the kid's agent, basically, his marketer, and only they can broker NIL deals for him. So if he tried to go to a different school, then they would just stop making NIL deals for him. And, you know, it's we talked to that lawyer, I talked to another lawyer, David Ubben talked to another lawyer, and what's going on right now that is alarming is that, you know, look, this particular player's family had this, was savvy enough to go have a lawyer look at the contract, but we think a lot of families are just signing and they don't know what they're signing away. They're signing away exclusive rights to NIL for the, sometimes in some cases, the duration of the career. I saw a draft version of a contract where they said, this is not the same player, but we're going to pay you $750,000 a year for 2 years, so $1.5 million. And then buried in the fine print was basically, he didn't say this explicitly, but basically if he's not earning that much, they can go in and ask for it back plus 10%. So our kids, I'm sure, are being taken advantage of and seeing these big dollar figures and signing things that they shouldn't be signing.
One thing that stepped up to me when you were discussing this a minute ago was, okay, we see lots of players go into the portal for all sorts of reasons. Let's say this player gets there in his first year, expectations are going to be sky high. Maybe the coordinator and he are not on the same page. Maybe the coordinator goes, maybe the system that they run ends up changing for whatever reason. Staffs, you know, come and go, maybe the head, you know, whatever. It's not a good fit. Then what happens?
Nobody knows because we haven't been through this before. I think the next couple of years of this could be real messy because promises are going to be made, contracts are going to be signed, and then reality is not going to match, you know, what's being said in the contract, and people are going to be trying to find ways out of it.
What happens, like, we've seen plenty of examples of, you said he's a five-star, that's, we'll keep it at that. But we've seen plenty of examples of five stars not delivering for all sorts of reasons. What happens if he's not, you know, struggles out of the gate and does not win a starting job?
Not only that, Bruce, but what if, think about this, right?
Or what if he just gets injured and just can't play?
What if he gets injured? Again, letter of the law, I saw the contract, there is nothing, there's no out. The only outs are if there's a confidentiality clause, and there's a clause that you would see this in any contract, right? Any profession, you know, about how you conduct yourself. And, you know, if you were to get arrested, if you were to bring embarrassment upon the you know, the entity, then they could use that as grounds to get out of it. But what if he's a perfectly model citizen? He's just not as good at football as they thought he would be. Or do they still have to pay him the money? And as far as I can tell, the answer is yes. Now, this is where I think there are so many consequences that are going to come if these collectives continue to be like this. Bruce, I would even say that another consequence of this is that arguably this collective now has more power over playing time than the coach. Because even if Mr. Five Star gets there and just is clearly not ready to be a starter at his position, are they really, does the coaching staff really going to keep the guy who's supposed to be making $2 million a year on the bench? He still gets his money regardless, but I would think that the people who are giving him the $2 million really, really want him to be out on the field and being a star. So I think the next few years, because this is still, everything right now is a first. You know, you asked me what happens if, and is nobody knows the answer because we've never been through this before. But it just seems to me that the amount of power that these third-party collectives hold now in recruiting, in relationships with the school, is bound to backfire. Like this, the intent is noble, at least the written intent, right? We're going to make sure that our favorite school's athletes have the best possible experience and maximize their NIL opportunities. That sounds great in theory. In reality, it's introduced an element where somebody other than the coach and his assistants has great influence over where the kid is going to go to school.
Let me ask you an inside baseball question. I'm curious what your thoughts on this are. So obviously somebody wanted this story out. Like whenever we do a story as a reporter, you think about, okay, why is this person becoming a source for me? Like, why are they, like, what do you think the people behind this wanted? Because it's clearly not to illuminate what's going on behind the scenes. It is something, is it to drive the market further? Is it kind of a billboard for, hey, this is how we're doing business. If you want to see one of these big deals, if you're a, you know, somebody who is feels like you're on the same level as this particular player, because a lot of people are going to know who this is. It's not that hard for people to connect the dots on this.
Well, you know, I can't speak to what agendas people may or may not have had. I can tell you that in my conversations with the lawyer who did the contract, Mike Caspino, what he seemed most fired up about is that all the bad, you know, unfavorable toward the athlete NIL contracts he's seeing, and wanting to get the word out that, you know, families, recruits, beware. Well, no, that he's pushing back, but because I was thinking about this, it's the most one-sided negotiation, because let's say the collective wants to have more restrictive language in there, and the attorney that's working with the kid pushes back. Is the collective really going to say no? They want the recruit. What, they can't play hardball. So his message is, hey, families, before you sign anything, you know, make sure a lawyer says this. I'm sure he wouldn't mind if he's the lawyer that sees it. But anyway,
tell me
have to sign the thing they give you at first.
Tell me from your experience now, having worked on this story for a little bit. So we have attorneys, we have collectives that are tied into individual schools. Are attorneys almost like agents in this regard, where they can represent people, they can represent different collective interests? Like, how?
In this particular case, he is, I mean, this, if you look up Mike Caspino, like, he represented a woman in a Supreme Court case about surrogacy. He's worked with the Roman Catholic Church. Like, this, he is not a sports agent by any means. He told me that he basically got exposed to it because his own son is a high school football player right now and is around a lot of recruits. But there are definitely agents there, and I'm not talking just like legit agents, like, you know, the kind of figures like we saw in the Reggie Bush scandal, right? Guys who see dollar signs and want to get involved in this and are making relationships with the kids, like, sure, no, I'll take care, I'll be your representative, I'll get you the best possible NIL deals. And then the next, you know, the kid has signed away his NIL rights to a guy who has no idea what he's doing. So it's a wild, wild west out there, because the NCAA is not regulating it in the slightest. They can't. They're not even trying to. And it's just like with everything, right? We see this in every walk of life. Where there's money to be made, there are going to be people looking to cash in who don't have the kid's best interests at heart.
So about a year ago at this time, I remember talking to some people inside the college football world, some coaches. One of the examples was put up, and I think this is a story we did on The Athletic, speaking of Reggie Bush, was if you're a USC booster and you wanted to say, hey, let's have Reggie Bush come to this booster's kid's birthday party, we can give him a $50,000 appearance fee. Realistically, you can give him a $100,000 appearance fee, and that money will add up fast. In your story, the appearance fees is basically one of the things that is written out. Is it not?
I was actually surprised. I went in there expecting to see, not necessarily dollar figures, what I expected to see was, in return for this, you will be expected to do 27 autograph signings or 32 birthday parties, something specific like that. Didn't, maybe other contracts have that in there. It didn't have any sort of specific parameters other than, you know, you will be expected to do appearances, social media promotions.
It's basically not spelled out. Like, a little bit.
It's not spelled out.
There's a vagueness to it that basically says, here's what matters. We're going to pay you this kind of money.
The way it's structured,
I don't
want
to say it's a no-show job.
Yeah.
But there, it kind of is the no-show job. You know,
All you have to do, this is what I was told pretty early on as we were learning about this. Because the NCAA ended up punting and barely put any rules on it, the only real rules are with NIL are, it can't be a recruiting inducement. It can't be pay for play.
It can't be a recruiting inducement, but everything you just said is a recruiting inducement.
Well, I'm saying in theory, it can't be a recruiting inducement. It can't be like, you know, the amount of money you get is tied to how many touchdowns you score. And it has to, there has to be some sort of quid pro quo. It can't just be like, here's a check. There has to be some conditions that are met, some legitimate NIL activity you have to do. But that's, I just explained to you how you get around the first two. And the third one, I mean, they're basically saying if the kid shows up and does like some meet and greets, I remember when the NCAA was going through this for years, they always intended for there to be some sort of regulation over market value. They wanted to make sure that people were being paid market value. And in the end of the day, it's just like the market value is whatever somebody will pay you. So I don't know. Let's say the kid ends up for his two, for his more than $2 million a year does ends up doing just like 20 NIL things in that year. That's $200,000 per appearance, which we all know is outrageous. But who's to say that's not what it costs, right? There's no governing body to say like, no, 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 that kind of autograph signing only pays $5,000. So, but basically the way it's structured. And I guess I should have explained this off the top. These money figures I'm talking about, like he's going to get within 10 days of signing the contract, $350,000, are advances. Just like when you write a book, Bruce, right? You get paid a very nice, like $8, $9 million advance.
full disclosure, that's not true. Go ahead.
But you get paid an advance, right? Yes. For the for a hypothetical, let's just say you get paid a $100,000 advance. Then the book starts getting sold. You're not going to see another dime above that until you've earned back out, yeah, the $100,000. And that's what this is. This kid is getting an advance against future NIL earnings. But the crazy thing is, like, who decides that whether he's actually made that back yet?
So
the collective does.
So one thing that happens when a story comes out like this is people comment, they weigh in. This is the worst. This is the craziest thing. This is the worst thing ever. Oh, this is, let me ask you, how do you feel about it?
I don't feel good about it, but I also feel...
Why do you not feel good about it?
The main thing I don't feel good about is that, is what I just said earlier. I don't think these third parties, who may or may not be even qualified to be doing this, now have so much influence in the sport of college football and in recruiting. I don't have a problem with the kids making the money. If somebody thinks this player is worth more than $2 million a year, good for him, you know? We talked about that with David Ubben. Like, we don't think there should be somebody coming in and like suppressing these kids' ability to make money. But as you said, how it works, the logistics of how that works is where it gets really dicey. And this is not a sustainable system that we're seeing sprout up here. Like, if he's going to get this much, how much is the next five star going to get? And how quickly does that keep growing? And how quickly, and Andy Staples has pointed this out, it will probably correct itself when these collectives realize they're not making anywhere near that much money back. They're paying this kid $8 million, and if he gets there and he only gets $1 million worth of NIL value, they've just cost themselves $7 million. Are they really going to make another deal like that?
Well, I think the question is going to be, can this player become Cam Newton for their program? Can he become, right, Saquon Barkley? To me, it's whatever their NIL value, I think I wouldn't hold on to that, because it's almost like trying to quantify, and I don't want to overstate this, is what I'm about to do, is like Mac Brown for the University of Texas raised a fortune for the Texas community, University of Texas community and everything and surrounding businesses. Frank Beamer taking Virginia Tech to another level. Obviously, Michael Vick had a sizable role in that too. Hotels get built, a lot of different things go up. If this player turns out to be a transformational, generational talent, then yes. And I think they're betting on this, but I come back.
It's a risky bet.
It is. It's a risky bet.
I think it's 50-50 whether he actually ends up being a star or not.
Because, well, yeah, I think just based
I'm on not talking about that specific player.
I mean, I know, like, you're just based on a five star. Yeah, I don't even know.
Yeah, about half of them, some of them will go on to be NFL All Pros, and some of them will never step foot on the field. You know,
more than likely, they will not be NFL All Pros. Like, yeah, they may be good players, but in terms of generational talents, I mean, look, if you look at the guys who would fit into turning around a program, you know, I mean, they're fewer than there are. I think one thing that I'm trying to see where I go with this, and I don't know if I have time to get into it. I don't think I have time to get into this.
Well, I'll just say this. When people, and I saw it in the comments and on Twitter, this is the death of college football. You know, a lot of like, thanks, sports writers. You finally got what you wanted. Now the whole sport's going to go to shit. First of all, I agree with David Ubben on our podcast, who said people just love their teams and the college football Saturdays so much that this is one of those things we get worked up in March when there's nothing else going on. But once they kick off that Ohio State Notre Dame game on September 4th, I believe 3rd, like, you're not going to be thinking about NIL when you're watching that game. Also,
Andy made it, I thought, a really good point on social media. Andy Staples did, where he, you know, and Andy loves to spar with people back and forth. And at one point, he said, I forgot what somebody was like, yeah, I'm done with this sport or something like that. And Andy said, wait a minute, if you go to a restaurant and you find out like the chef is all, or the person who serves your meal is making a ton of money, do you not like the food as much? You know, like, and I'm
I
paraphrasing what
don't
he
think, but I
said.
don't think that's the negative thing people are. I could be wrong. I'm sure some people think, yeah,
There's a
no
quaint notion
17-year-olds
of
make
it.
that.
There's a quaint notion of
It's
the.
the aspect that it's an uneven playing field.
It's always been an uneven
Exactly.
playing
The
field.
notion that a school that has a donor who's particularly overzealous goes and gets this kid to come to their school, that's not fair. But
But that's
again, I
always
don't
been the way
think,
it's been. It's just
yeah,
now.
but some people don't necessarily understand that or agree with that. And
I mean, because
I will
they
say,
think only
like,
their school is not cheating.
correct. That's always been, that was in my book 20, 15 years ago. Everybody cheats, but except us. The other thing is, and I'll say this till the end of time, no matter what negative consequences might come from NIL being legalized, it was still the right thing to legalize. It was the ethically, morally, like we're talking about 6 million, 7 million. As of July, June 30th, the last year, it was still $0 that any athlete could make from use of their name, image, and likeness. And so, you know, this story, this $8 million is getting the attention, but like there are all these athletes who you've never even heard of, who are playing in the non-revenue sports, who are now able to, you know, make a little spending money, buy some nicer clothes because they have a decent following on Instagram and they can actually monetize it. Or the lacrosse player in her, who's a hero in her hometown, who can go hold a clinic with her name on it, which she couldn't do before, and make a little money that way. That was the reason NIL needed to be legalized. What's going on with football recruiting is a mess, and they'll need to figure that out, but that don't penalize every other athlete in America, college athlete in America, and keep them from you know, realizing their value because the NCAA can't figure out how to regulate this.
If you want to read that story, go to theathletic.com/theaudible to get our special offer. It's only $1 a month for the next 6 months on new subscriptions.
What do you say we get to our guest?
Okay, Stu, we are pleased to be joined by our guest. It is the new head coach of the Oregon Ducks, Dan Lanning. Dan, thanks for joining us today on the Audible.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right, so a lot of people know you. Obviously, you helped Georgia win a national title with an awesome defense. I mean, a ridiculous amount of talent you were coordinating there. But for people who might not know, you have been in the Pac-12 before. You spent a couple of years at Arizona State. I guess it's now almost a decade ago. I would ask you this, especially when you were in the conference. I mean, Oregon at that point was, they were an offensive juggernaut and just, whipping people. The program, Mario Cristobal, who you worked with, I guess at Alabama, he just really kind of got it going and just, recruited really well. They're physical and everything else. What do you want to do? What do you feel like you need to do to elevate the Ducks to take maybe that next step to be in a team that could be where Georgia just was and is?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's small steps. It's day by day. Big piece for us is obviously we want to take care of business in this conference and become a dominant force on the West Coast. And you do that by building off, you know, what's been established here. But, you know, also going forward, you got to go compete in those big games outside of here. And, Mario and his crew, they won against Ohio State last year and then stubbed their toe a little bit in some of the Pac-12 games. We want to go be able to complete those games, and finish that off. But continue to develop on the talent, grow in the trenches. You know, we have a strong offensive line. Coach did a good job of recruiting that and build off of that talent up front. I think that can really take us to another level when you're able to build that on defense as well.
And Dan, you're known for obviously, I mean, last year's Georgia defense was unbelievably talented and physical. And yeah, but I'm also, as you're on this Zoom, there's a Sports Illustrated cover of Marcus Mariota right next to you. Oregon football for a lot of people is still synonymous with the high tempo offense and great quarterbacks. How do you go about melding the two? I mean, your background is in you guys showed last year, you know, a year after Nick Saban said you can't win with defense anymore, you guys showed you can, absolutely can. But people think of Oregon football, they think of that guy right there and certainly Justin Herbert and a lot of other guys like that.
Absolutely. I mean, I'll say this, as a defensive coordinator the last 3 years, there's nothing more than a defensive coordinator likes than a great offense, right? So we want to go score points. You know, we want to be dynamic on that side of the ball. And when you think of Oregon 100%, you think of Marcus, you think of what they've done offensively here in the past, but there's also some great defensive history. But we want to build on that offense. I don't think people should understand we're not coming here to, you know, win a game 3-0. That's not our goal. We want to score some points. We want to push the tempo. We want to make, you know, defenses uncomfortable. And when I think of Oregon outside of just offense, I think about innovative. And we want to be innovative in our approach on the offensive and defensive side of the ball and the way we attack.
So now that you're in, you've had a couple of spring practices to see what you got. Being at the combine, there was an insane amount of Georgia guys on defense that you had. Where would Noah Sewell have played on that defense? And like, you'd still have some guys that probably you would have had to find a way into too deep. But is it a question of, okay, we're going to build off of a blueprint there, or what is the things where you look at? Because obviously you have, as you said, a pretty good offensive line, but now in terms of quarterback, you got a transfer, Bo Nix, who you know a bunch about. You got some other guys who have, you know, were highly recruited when they came in. How quickly do you feel like you can put your really stamp on this, or is it just kind of the next, whatever, 13 practices, hey, let's figure out what we actually got as opposed to maybe what we thought we had in these guys when maybe we looked at them as recruits?
Yeah, I think there's still a lot of time, you know, to figure that out. We've had 2 practices, but not a single practice yet in pads, you know, so a lot of that comes out. Football is really a game to be, you know, to be played with shoulder pads and a helmet, you know, and once we really see over the next 13 practices what we have, I think that's when you start to curtail what you do. You start with a base. You know, you have a foundation of here's what we're going to be built around, but the tweaks, the changes here and there, a lot of that starts with figuring out where your strengths are and what your depth looks like. You know, I was a high school coach for 3 years before I ever became a college football coach. And every year you would change a lot based on your personnel. And even at Georgia, you know, we were really a strong, dominant team defensively. We had a strong back end, you know, 2 years ago and probably played to those strengths a little bit. And then this past year, we were really strong in the front 7 and really played to those strengths. So we're going to adapt to our personnel, whether it be, you know, the front, whether it be quarterback. I'm really excited about the competition we have there between Butterfield, Ty Thompson, Nix in that room, but still too early to say what we have. I think we have to keep evaluating that.
It used to be when a new coach took over, the only way he could really build up the roster was through recruiting. Now we have the transfer portal, and we've seen, I mean, there's a lot of coaches taking over at high profile programs this year, and some of them went hard on the portal and some of them not so much. I mean, you mentioned Bo Nix, but in general, like when you came in, how did you decide between we're going to load up on transfers for right now, or we want to save those more for high school players?
You know, I think we have to keep evaluating this 2 to 3 years from now. I think people really know the model and what it looks like. We want to use the portal to enhance our program, but that's not the only place that we want to live. I still believe in developing talent from the ground up and bringing guys in as high school players to build your culture. That being said, we brought some guys in that we're really excited about, that we really had intimate knowledge about, you know, and I think some programs will make mistakes by going and reaching for guys that they don't know a lot about and bringing them in and hoping it's a fit. But you really don't know if they're going to be a fit until you have a great understanding of your current team, your current roster, and the people you're bringing in. So for us, it's about meeting the guys on our team here, really getting to know who we have in this room, connecting with those guys, because that's going to be the group that wins and loses us football games. And then we want to be able to add those pieces to the puzzle, you know, through the portal. It can make us a little bit better here and there.
Dan, like, you have some very recognizable names that you brought in. A couple guys come back from the NFL, Tosh Lupoi, who I think you worked with at Alabama, and he has a ton of experience recruiting on the West Coast. Your O-line guy, Adrian Clem, former UCLA assistant, been with the Steelers the past couple of years, obviously a ton of experience recruiting on the West Coast. Your offensive coordinator, Kenny Dillingham, I don't think you guys over, I thought you did, but I guess you didn't overlap at ASU, but he's an Arizona guy. So when you assembled this staff, I'm curious, like, at what point in your, you know, as a coach who was on people's radar for a while, like, when did you look at Kenny? Was it, you know, going back to the Memphis days, or was it way before where you go like, hey, if I ever become a head coach, he's going to be that guy? Like, how are you as a managing Georgia's defense, but also this is going to be my blueprint of the guys and what I'm looking for.
Yeah. One thing I've found, at least progressing in my career, is if you say, okay, I'm going to do this when I get the opportunity, you'll never truly be prepared. So, you know, one thing I learned from Coach Smart and Coach Saban both is take detailed notes as you go and adapt as you go. But whenever I came across an elite coach or somebody I thought was a game changer, you know, I made a mental note. And going all the way back to my time as a GA at Arizona State, I had a list in my iPhone of potential coaching candidates I would hire, you know, by position, what they look like. And, you know, fortunately, a lot of these guys on staff I've worked with, you know, whether it be Kenny Dillingham at Memphis or Joe Lorig at Arizona State and Memphis, Tosh at Alabama, you know, Matt Pallage at Sam Houston State. There's a lot of these guys that we've overlapped, maybe at different places, but I knew in the back of my mind, if I get the opportunity, I want to hire him. And then there's guys like Adrian Clem, who I didn't work with, but I went against. And I saw his offensive lines. I saw how he recruited this level. And was really fortunate that I didn't have to go far down my list here at Oregon when I got here because of the support from the administration and the excitement around our program. You know, we were able to attract good coaches because they see what this place is and they understand, you know, who I am and what I want to piece together. So that was a fun process, but it wasn't like, hey, you got the job. All right, let's scramble and figure out who we're signing, who we're bringing on board. Kenny and I talk ball every offseason. Tosh and I do, you know, did professional development for years, and getting to coach with them obviously strengthened that relationship. So it was important to bring people in that I trust, that I thought were great, you know, great with relationships. In today's day and age, you have to have guys that are great relationship guys and then great teachers. You know, I think those are the things that can change the game for us.
Dan, your program played in national championship games in 2010 and 2014. Obviously, the sport has changed a lot since then, and we've seen the SEC and just the Southeast, Clemson, really dominate this sport. And at the same time, the Pac-12 hasn't had a team in the playoffs since 2016. What makes you confident that in this climate, a team from the West Coast can still be among those elite teams nationally?
You know, probably it starts for me knowing with what we just did it with at Georgia, that there's a lot of West Coast talent on those teams, you know, our team at Georgia. And if we're able to keep that talent home, that's one place where it can start, right? Be able to play with those guys here at this place and build that brand. Now, I also know that we're close and college football is about to become the haves and the have-nots. And we're unique in a situation here where we have great support, great backing from a fan base, but also from people that have interest in our program being successful. And when you're able to have that support in the day and age of name, image, likeness, in the day and age of the transfer portal, I think it gives you a chance. And people are excited about it. You know, this conference has been, you know, reinvigorated right now. And it's exciting to see what it's going to turn out to next year when we get a chance to compete against some of those other teams.
Dan, if I told you, for people who maybe don't know your background, you were William Jewell College linebacker in the Midwest. Not that long ago, obviously you're 35. If I told you when you were a senior, not too far down the road, you were going to have been on Nick Saban's staff, won a national title as a DC for Kirby Smart, and then got not just a FBS head coaching job, but when you were in college, Oregon was rolling at that point too. What would 21-year-old Dan Lanning have thought that you would have been able to do all those things?
You know, I don't know if I ever dreamed having a career that's been as rewarding as my career has been. And I know how fortunate I am to be exactly where I'm at right now. You know, I'm truly blessed. I've been fortunate to know and be around great coaches. And that's been a benefit for me. But I also feel like I created some of that luck and that fortune myself by places I've been and how hard I worked when I got there. One thing for me is every single day I competed to be the best wherever I was at. And the big goal is that led to opportunities down the road when you did that. And I think that's, you know, it's all coming to fruition, you know, firsthand. And those experiences, they're super rewarding. But could I have ever dreamed of it at 21? No. You know, at that point, I certainly thought I could have been a high school coach my entire career and would have been very happy doing that. But it's been a blessing, a super special place that I see, you know, exceptional things happening for us down the road. And just enjoying the journey has been a lot of fun for me.
One quick follow-up on that. I'm curious, having been at Sam Houston State to go see Longo when he was there, and I met some of your colleagues, I remember going to, I forgot where we went for Tex-Mex for lunch, but like definitely, you know, a real successful program, but kind of off the beaten path. Yeah. You go from there to Tuscaloosa. Like, walk us through when you realize, man, I just got up. Not to say that Arizona State wasn't, but that is the big break. So what, how did that come about, and how were you able to, like, all right, I'm here now? Like, walk us through that kind of transition.
You know, I think early in my career, one thing that I really focused on was opportunity, not the dollar sign. And a lot of people probably don't realize this, but early on, I didn't make a lot of money in this profession. In fact, it was more like donating money to be in the profession. And at Sam Houston State, that was kind of my first break. I was a full-time coach. I was coaching the DBs. We were, a very successful team. Got to play North Dakota State in the semifinals. And after that season, I got an opportunity to go interview for a graduate assistant position at Alabama. But it wasn't a job that was going to pay a lot of money. But that was another example for me where a lot of people might have said, hey, this doesn't make sense financially with a wife and three kids. For me, it was the opportunity. And being a GA, whether you're making $1,000 a month or not, that opportunity was one I couldn't pass up. And I always said to going there, I'm going to go get my doctorate in football. And every day I walked into that building and I just felt like I had a lot to learn. And I learned a ton in that year in football, whether it be from one of the many head coaches that were on that staff, Coach Cristobal, Coach Mel Tucker, Lane Kiffin, Kirby Smart, Nick Saban, Billy Napier. It's just a group of all-star coaches that I was able to really be around every single day and see how they operate. And you can't replace that experience with any dollar sign. And that was, for me, being able to compete at that level, being that environment day in and day out, I just grew so much as a coach that's when I realized that you can't put limits on yourself. If you're willing to work hard and you're in a place where you can learn, limit.
Well, Dan, I know you're only two practices in, so the season opener seems a long ways away, and I'm sure you're going to get asked this a lot in the next few months, but I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this. Your first game as a head coach is going to be against the school that you just won a national championship with. Like, you're celebrating with Kirby Smart and Stetson Bennett and all those guys. You're going to face them in early September. What do you think that'll be like?
I'm super rewarding. I'm really proud of everything that we accomplished at Georgia. And I've got a tremendous amount of respect for Coach Smart, that staff. I still have a lot of love for every one of those players in that program. So it certainly means a lot to me, but I also like to play to win. And we're excited to go out there and compete, put the best product that we can on the field and see where the thing goes.
Hey, Dan, I want to ask you one question, because Stu and I have talked about this a bunch over the last couple of days, and it's you're becoming a head coach at the time when NIL is exploding. One of the points Stu had made, because we were talking about this offline a little bit, is, does the power shift where collectives now maybe have more influence over rosters than ever before? How is it head coach? How do you prepare to manage kind of that dynamic as it's – these are uncharted waters, really.
Yeah, it's super fluid. And I think it's important, at least for me, that you don't take hard stances one direction or the other. And you have to be able to adapt on the fly. 2 years ago, no one was really, playing for the portal. And that game's obviously completely changed. People realize you can change your roster quickly with a couple additions here or there. Or your situation can change when a couple guys leave here or there. And I think name, image, likeness is very similar. What you don't want to do is be in a place where you're not competitive and you're not innovative. And that's the one thing that I'm excited about with Oregon is, coming here, they have a distinct plan. They know how to attack. This place was built on innovative, and we're kind of operating that same approach when it comes to the name, image, likeness programs. But there's definitely never been more influence and never been anything as important as that piece going forward.
I mean, I think a lot of people would assume that Oregon, we've long known about the Nike connection, and Kayvon Thibodeau was doing things with NFTs before I knew what an NFT was last year. Like, that you that you guys would of all programs would be in a pretty good place to be in this NIL climate.
Yeah, we're sitting in a great situation. But I think the thing that's awesome about this place is no one's comfortable. Right. It would be really easy to say, OK, yeah, we've got all this support. We've got the Nike. We're already ahead of the curve and say, OK, we're going to stay there. But the reality is we're going to continue to push the envelope. We're going to continue to figure out ways to be better and, keep broadening our horizons as we move forward.
All right, Dan, we appreciate your time, especially in the middle of spring ball. We're hopefully get up and see you. As you said, this place was built on innovation, and that's a pretty cool thing to be to have as really like your mission statement in a lot of ways. So best of luck there.
Appreciate you guys. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, Dan. We'll see you soon.
All right. Have a good one.
Take care. All right, Stu, let's get to the mailbag. As always, send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. Stu, the first question is from Walt. Hey, Stu and Bruce, after the ACC, Big Ten, and Pac-12 voted against an early 12-team playoff, is it realistic to think the SEC would design their own playoff? And what would it look like, Stu? Let's tie this into our colleague Andy Staples. Spoke to Greg Sankey, the SEC commissioner. Had an interesting story over the weekend, or maybe it was Friday.
Yeah, I think he was at the basketball tournament, and you know, there. I know that maybe it was even Andy that wrote it. There was some talk when the thing initially broke down that the SEC would just go and form its own playoff, and then you know, if you guys want to, the rest of the country want to pool together and have somebody play our champion, so be it. That's not going to happen. But I think Greg Sankey is going to, I think he feels like he made compromises that they wouldn't necessarily have liked to be able to get that thing through, and it didn't happen. So now they're going to dictate the terms. And I think an interesting point that he makes in the interview with Andy is, you know, I'll read you the exact quote. "We have to rethink our positioning," he said. "I don't know what the number will be. I still think there's a reason that 12 works. But the notion of just granting conference champions the top four seeds, we're going to rethink that. That was a give, as people wanted conference champions. But now people want something else." So if in the 12-team model that Greg Sankey himself was one of the authors on, the top four seeds were conference champions. In fact, it was noted that last year, Georgia would have been the number five seed because they wouldn't have been able to get any higher because they didn't win their conference championship. Greg Sankey hinting there that, you know, well, we tried to play nice. Now we want a system where if SEC teams are ranked 1, 3, and 4, then they get the 1, 3, and 4 seeds. And that others will, if that were to come to that, others would obviously object. But at the end of the day, who has the most leverage in these playoff discussions?
It's a strong point, and I think that if you're Greg Sankey or anybody looking at it, say, yeah, could you blame him? I mean, the examples you just used, everything bears out. Right now, these other conferences, especially the Pac-12, you know, they don't have a strong footing to play on. And some of the rationale, I mean, some of it's been explained, some of it is not. You know, it's been kind of a head scratcher, to be honest.
I think you're going to see, you know, everybody talks about the alliance, but if you notice, there was starting to be unofficially a counter alliance. Bob Bowlsby has clearly decided that, you know, whatever happened with expansion is over, and he's completely aligned with Sankey on the playoff stuff. Jack Swarbrick is completely aligned with Sankey on the playoff stuff, and the group of five, I don't know if they would be aligned with him on this conference championship component, because obviously they would want to protect their conference champion. But
so it's Kevin Warren and from the Big Ten, and George Kliavkov, who's even newer than Kevin Warren from the Pac-12. Reading the tea leaves, tell me what you see.
For the next playoff?
No, well, as they approach the next round of discussions that are now further, the can's been kicked down the road.
I think that everybody's going to make sure that their champion, like if the thing that if Sankey proposed it, nobody would.
Yeah, I think what's going to be interesting here is you have the Big Ten has its TV rights, which will get sorted out sooner than later. It's going to be a lot of money we're talking about. I don't know. Like, do you think that situation will influence where the Big Ten goes down the road?
Oh, I see what you mean. You know, I think at the end of the day, the discussions that led to from the BCS to the 4-team playoff, every conference was part of those discussions. It basically came down to the Big Ten versus the SEC, what the Big Ten wanted versus what the SEC wanted, and they reached a compromise. And those two are so far above everybody else in terms of influence and money that by the time we get to 2026, it'll be even more so. So the question is, will the Big Ten, how much does the Big Ten plan to stick to this alliance? Because, you know,
are they sticking to the alliance actually, though?
We started to see the first cracks.
I don't think they're sticking to the alliance.
We don't really see the need to do the scheduling thing after all.
They don't have the same rationale for their decisions. I don't see
the Big Ten on its own. Like, basically, if you were forming a college football playoff from scratch and the ACC pulled what they just did, you'd be like, well, okay, we'll move on without you. You know, like, the country's not going to have a meltdown if the ACC is not part of the playoff. Same thing with the Pac-12. Same thing probably with the new Big 12. But you got to have the Big Ten. You got to have the SEC. And so I think the next round of discussions will basically be about what each of those wants and who gets more of what.
Okay.
Don't you?
Yeah, I think it's like, who is, you know, again, I feel like the alliance was drastically overstated and overhyped as it relates to what seems to really matter in college football. And I don't know who is going, like, what is going to be the influence that is going to be deciding the top of the conferences, you know, 3 years from now or whatever it is. Once we get through this big, I would say money grab, but that's basically what it's going to be.
You're also going to, I mean, you mentioned the Big Ten TV deal, but you're also going to have a new Pac-12 deal, which is they've been waiting for this day for however long. And you're going to have the Big 12, the first TV deal of the new Big 12 without Texas and Oklahoma. And we're going to come out of that period and be like, okay, so this is what the landscape looks like now. And I think I'm not really optimistic for the Pac-12 and the Big 12, how much money they're going to make in that. And so when they go to the kind of crazy thing about those conferences blocking it this time around is I think they'll have less leverage next time around than they did this time around. It would have been in their best interest to go ahead and get it done, but we're not going to go back through that again.
I agree. Next up.
From David, gentlemen, thanks for the excellent discussion debate regarding your top 25 coach lists. I'll even forgive Bruce's heroic, though ultimately unpersuasive defense of Chip Kelly at 16. It should be noted that I believe David is a USC fan. You guys have somewhat different criteria for lists, so I wondered if you might play the following game. If money were no object and you were the AD of a big-time program and ignoring geography, who would be the first five coaches in order that you would approach? And I'm curious whether those would be the same as the top five on your current list.
I'm just reading this now.
And then he says, if you were the AD of a program with a more modest, but you know what? Let's do the second part. Because I think the first part, we'd all say Chip Kelly, Dabo Swinney. If you're the AD of a program with a more modest budget, who would be the first five you would approach?
Modest budget. I would, the first name that comes to mind on that would be, there's guys that maybe didn't make our list. I guess I got to figure out what exactly do we talk about as a modest budget here.
Well, let's just pick a school. Matt Campbell leaves Iowa State. They've got to hire a replacement. They know they're not going to get Dabo Swinney. They're not going to get Ryan Day. They're not going to get these guys who are expecting $6, $7, $8 million. But they can get somebody who $4 million a year would be plenty. Who are they calling?
Okay, I don't know if you can get Dave Clawson for that money. I think you can get Jamie Chadwell for that money. I would go after Jamie Chadwell. I know he was just missed a cut, I think, on both our lists. He would be a guy. $4 million is not, I mean, it's a lot of money, but relative to all these guys on our top 25, it's not. I would.
Yeah, I mean, that was Campbell's salary as of 2021.
Yeah, like, I think, you know, just use the example Iowa State. I don't think they can get him because he's making more than this. But Dana Holgorsen's actually from Iowa, went to college in Iowa. I think he's a really, really brilliant offensive mind. But you're not going to, I mean, you're not going to get him to leave Houston for that kind of money. That's why I would stick.
You don't think he would leave? Well, I guess they're going to be in the same conference.
No, he wouldn't. So, he's in a big market. He has a lot of connections in Houston. He's got a way bigger recruiting base right now. So,
what about Hugh Freeze?
Hugh Freeze to Ames, huh?
I believe that would be a raise. Although Liberty does throw money around quite a bit.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you gave me a example, like almost like modest money. Now,
never mind. Hugh Freeze makes $4 million annually.
if you said 5.5 million, which is like crazy to think that that's like, you know, the guys that it could get, Jeff Monken, it could certainly, I would think, get Bill Clark, probably Lance Leipold, but that's probably the extent of it on guys on our list. Right?
Well, I thought Kansas should have hired Jeff Monken, though I do think
they did well. Lance
Leipold. Okay. Yeah. I think either guy was so I think, you know, obviously I'd be pushing for Monken, I'd be pushing for Chadwell, like you said, Bill Clark would be a really good one. I'm trying to think of like a maybe lower down power five we're not thinking of.
A lower down power five. He's making more than this, but Jeff Brohm.
Yeah, I think he's what about, okay, I have a good one. I don't know what he makes now. Let's just try to get money out of the equation. It's this tier of coaches and you're trying to hire them. And he said, like, we're in some random geographic location. What about, I'm thinking maybe somebody like Jonathan Smith.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. I mean, he's done a nice job there. I mean, he's got a lot of ties, obviously, up in Corvallis and on the West Coast. I don't know, you know, how that one plays if you take him to Iowa State. You know, I feel like he's a better fit where he's at, but.
He's a better fit where he's at, but is he, like, enough of a tactician? And by the way, he only makes 2.4, that, you know, you think he'd have success wherever he goes.
What is success? You know, like right now,
I think Iowa State success is to try to like keep doing what Matt Campbell's been doing and maybe occasionally rise up and win the conference.
Yeah, it's not bad. Like there are certain guys like you're going to probably bet on the come. You know, again, it's like I go back to Jamie Chadwell on that. I think it's can you do what he's doing there at a group of five program and build off it. After that, I think it's kind of, it's a gamble, you know, to see how it fits regionally, you know. Let's go back to the beginning of his question. If you were to say five guys on the top end, ignoring geography, and let's take Saban out of it, you know. You know who I would have high on my list on this? And maybe I'm, you know, my first name, I think, would be Lincoln Riley. He's never won a national title. He hasn't actually, you know, he's been in the playoff. But you know what you're getting offensively. You know you can sell him as a recruit. I know from talking to guys who have been recruited by him that they know he will work at it. And I think you could sell him all over the country. He's not a regional fit. I think he would be really high on my list of that if you said top five.
And with that, we lost every last Oklahoma listener.
No.
I don't disagree. I don't know if he'd be my first one, but he would be.
Who would be your first
one? He'd be one of the five. I can't see you saying Saban's off the table,
let's,
right?
Let's.
But is Kirby Smart on the table?
Kirby Smart is on the table.
Yeah, I would call him.
Brian Kelly's on the table. Dabo's on the table.
I'd call Ryan Day. I'd call Dabo.
All of them before Lincoln Riley?
I'd call Lincoln Riley before Dabo because I'm feeling a little bit. I mean, he deserves to be number two on the list for what he's done. I'm feeling a little bit of concern about what's to come from here for Dabo because I feel like he just lost to, you know, extremely important coordinators. And also just he's a stubborn guy and the sport is changing so quickly. And is he going to be able to adapt to the transfer portal NIL era?
My top two guys, neither one has won a national title or played for it technically or been in the title game. Actually, that's not true. My other two guy almost won it actually, Ryan Day. Again, Ryan Day, a little like Lincoln Riley, where they both have very hands-on offensive guys. I'm going to throw out something on Ryan Day that I do value. And I'm not saying other guys aren't like this, but Ryan Day has been, and I think he deserves a ton of credit for this, especially, you know, it's like a story that was in the college football news a little bit recently where a former five-star offensive lineman, Harry Miller, had been very public about his battle with mental health issues. And Ryan Day, who has used his platform to be very vocal and supportive of the cause of the issues of mental health in ways, and I'm not saying other coaches don't talk about it, but he and his wife have been very proactive in it, and it is impacting people in a really positive way. And I would want, if I was an AD, he's obviously a terrific coach, but I also think he is championing something very important right now, and I would want that. And that might be a reason. I wouldn't necessarily say that would be a distinction for me on our top 25 list to push Ryan Day above somebody else. But I think if I was an AD and I wanted somebody representing my school, I really am awed by what he's doing, because I think it's really important. It's important to him because of what his family's experienced and what he has experienced. But I think that's something that, you know, it is college football, and I think you're dealing with college athletes, and I think that would matter to me.
I agree with everything you just said. I noticed you did not bring that up on the podcast we did with Ralph Russo, where he was telling us why he had Ryan Day so much lower than us. Like, you saved that for this one.
I didn't think of it like, no, but the context of David's question is,
yeah,
you know,
who would you... Well, so like, who, like, as a person,
would you approach?
I
was very, you know, like the comments from that player were so heartfelt and so powerful.
Well, first of all, it was so jaw dropping. I mean, that he went public and said, and I believe it was one of the very first sentences that. I think he said before last season or on the start of last season, I went to Ryan Day and told him that I planned to kill myself. And, you know, we know from his history, from Ryan Day's own personal history, how, you know, if there's any coach that would have been able prepared to handle that situation, it's him. And he, you know, he's retired from football, but he's given him a role still in the program. And, you know, you can tell the player is just incredibly grateful to him.
Yeah. And I saw there was another player at Temple who echoed Harry Miller's sentiment. And I just think it's very impactful, not just with 18 to 22 year olds, but I think to be able to have that platform, use it that way to impact people, where it's like, because this guy in Harry Miller's case, because this other player has done it, like, I just think that is, you know, for all the stuff that people can go, yeah, this, you know, we were talking before about NIL and how some fans, you know, just roll their eyes at it and where the game is headed and everything else. And there's plenty of stuff to be cynical about on social media. But for me, for that, and I don't think like Ryan Day to me, is, you know, he's not like super out there in terms of outspoken. You're not going to see him everywhere or whatever, but I think that is an important cause to him and his family. And I think it's such an important one. And we see how important it is more, you know, time and time again, especially now. So he would be my top guy just because what he does on the field, but what he's also been about. And I'll stand by that one.
Okay. Here's another coach ranking related question from Mike DiDonna. Why do you guys keep using winning national championships as a main reason why a coach should be considered good? There are many good coaches who have never won one, and many coaches who have won one by sheer circumstance. And he lists Gene Chizik, Larry Coker, Les Miles, I disagree with that one, Bobby Ross, and Danny Ford. I don't think at any point these guys would have been considered a top 25 coach. Okay, maybe Les Miles. I think that I get where he's coming from in that maybe unlike pro sports, where there's a reason why winning the championship is the end-all be-all barometer, because the college football postseason is very arbitrary. Sometimes, you know, if you go back through history, right, you can find all kinds of seasons where two teams went 12-1. One team got to play for the national championship, the other didn't. And that's going to happen less often now, the bigger the field gets. But I always think of Mark Richt at Georgia, who I think had a tremendous tenure there, but is not not necessarily comes up when people think talk about all-time great college football coaches. And he had that 2002 team with David Pollack and David Green, and they went, I think, 13-1, but they happened to that team happened to exist in the same season as Ohio State and Miami, who, when they played that legendary national championship game. Like, another season, that same exact record might have gotten them in the national championship game. So I get what he's saying from that extent, but at the same time, like, how, you know, especially now in the playoff era, how do we not give guys bonus points for winning the most important prize in the sport?
Right. I mean, look, if Jimbo didn't win the national title at FSU, would he be in your top 10?
No, he wouldn't. And so if you're going, but I also don't think that there was nothing. The thing is, there was nothing fluky. That wasn't a Gene Chizik gets Cam Newton for a year championship. That was, I mean, they were absolutely dominant, and you know, earned every bit of that national championship. Yes, Jameis Winston obviously was a phenom. But guess what? Jimbo's produced a lot of other first round quarterbacks as well. So, there's a case to be made that we all have him overrated being in the top 10 for what he's accomplished more recently, but you know, he's a national championship coach. Mack Brown's a national championship coach, and I'm not necessarily applying it as strongly to him because that was in 2005.
Okay. As always, send your questions and comments to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We will see you next time. Thank you.